Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The end of Roe. In a historic move, the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, almost a half century after it guaranteed women the right to an abortion. We take an in-depth look at the justice's momentous decision and the ramifications it will have now and for years to come.
I can't even remember when the Supreme Court last revoked a right an American citizen held.
And it's Friday. Jonathan Capehart and Michael Gerson weigh in on the Supreme Court's ruling and the passage of bipartisan gun safety legislation in Congress. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. It is a tectonic shift on abortion rights. The U.S. Supreme Court today remade the legal landscape, throwing out the precedent laid down 50 years ago in Roe versus Wade. We'll be dedicating most of tonight's program to the decision and the praise and protest that it has touched off. John Yang begins our coverage.
Outside the Supreme Court, jubilation and celebration for some. For others, rage coupled with resolve. Today's decision had been much anticipated since early May when Justice Samuel Alito's draft opinion was leaked. The court's ruling ends the constitutional right to an abortion, a right that had been the law of the land for nearly 50 years. Alito wrote the majority opinion, joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. The liberal justices, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, dissented. Chief Justice John Roberts did not join his conservative colleagues in overturning Roe. He said there was no need to do that in order to uphold a 15-week Mississippi abortion ban that was the subject of the case. At the White House, President Biden quickly condemned the decision and urged Congress to act.
The court has done what it has never done before. Expressly take away a constitutional right that is so fundamental to so many Americans that it had already been recognized. The court's decision to do so will have real and immediate consequences. The only way we can secure a woman's right to choose and the balance that existed is for Congress to restore the protections of Roe v. Wade as federal law.
In a statement, former President Trump called the ruling the biggest win for life in a generation. He went on to take credit for it, saying it was only made possible because I delivered everything as promised. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi weighed in at her weekly news conference.
American women today have less freedom than their mothers. For 50 years, a constitutional right for a woman having the right to choose. The hypocrisy is raging. But the harm is endless.
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy claimed a win.
The people have won a victory. The right to life has been vindicated. The voiceless will finally have a voice. This great nation can now live up to its core principle that all are created equal, not born equal, created equal.
Today's ruling is likely to lead to abortion bans in about half the states. Some have laws triggered by the overturning of Roe or pre-Roe laws still on the books. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel said her state's 1931 law is unenforceable.
In the event that the Court of Appeals or later the Michigan Supreme Court were to overturn that, then the 1931 law would spring back into effect. But as of right now, it is unenforceable. So everything remains the same as it was yesterday at this time, but just for now.
Corporate America also responded. The Walt Disney Company announced it would pay for employees' travel if it was needed to access family planning and reproductive care. Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Netflix, and Amazon, among others, had already pledged to offer similar benefits. From overseas, leaders weighed in on the historic ruling. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
I think it's a big step backwards. I've always believed in a woman's right to choose, and I stick to that view, and that's why the UK has the laws that it does.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tweeted it was horrific. French Prime Minister Emmanuel Macron wrote, abortion is a fundamental right for all women.
This is what democracy looks like.
As the day wore on, the crowd outside the Supreme Court grew. Gatherings are expected in cities across the country later tonight. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
To unpack today's Supreme Court opinion, including its conservative majority and the liberal dissent, we turn now to Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal. Welcome back to the program, Marcia. This is a big one. Put this in context, though. In the pantheon of major Supreme Court decisions, where does this one fit?
This is huge. It's been, I can't even remember when the Supreme Court last revoked a right an American citizen held. And so this one was nearly 50 years old, had also been reaffirmed multiple times.
And rolling the clock back, essentially. Is that right?
Absolutely, it does. There will be a patchwork of laws around the nation, either having abortion legal or illegal. Will we see some of the deaths and injuries that occurred pre-Roe when desperate women may have gone to back alley type abortions? I don't know. It will depend on how some of these abortion laws are structured.
We did have an inkling this was coming, the leaked draft opinion written by Justice Alito that came out in May, and we see some of that same language in this opinion. I want to quote from part of today's decision, and I'm quoting, "We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision, including the one on which the defenders of Roe and Casey now chiefly rely. That provision has been held to guarantee some rights that are not mentioned in the Constitution, but any such right must be, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. And the right to abortion does not fall within this category." So explain what the Justice Alito was getting at there.
Judy, the conservative majority on this court approaches the Constitution and constitutional rights by looking at the text of the Constitution, tradition, and history. There are many respected American historians who disagree and also challenge the ability of the court and judges in general to do the kind of historical research that is required to reach these kinds of conclusions. But be that as it may, the majority did do that analysis and found that, as I said, abortion did not fall in that category.
So, Marcia, as we see, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, he does sign on to the majority opinion, but he also writes a separate concurring opinion saying the court erred, in his words, by completely overruling Roe and Casey. And I'm just quoting from what he wrote. He said, "If it is not necessary to decide more to dispose of a case, then it is necessary not to decide more. Surely we should adhere closely to principles of judicial restraint here, where the broader path the court chooses entails repudiating a constitutional right we have not only previously recognized, but also expressly reaffirmed, applying the doctrine of stare decisis." So do you see the Chief Justice saying?
He wanted to only deal with the line that Roe and Casey drew about abortion bans, that you could not ban abortion before viability. That's at 22 to 24 weeks. He felt that that was not a clearly justified line. He was concerned about the court's legitimacy in making this ruling at this time. And he agreed with that part of the Alito majority opinion that did get rid of the viability line, but he would not, as you said, go so far as to overrule the entire Roe and Casey decisions.
And Marcia, as we know, there was a strongly worded dissent by the three liberal justices. Here is part of what they wrote in today's opinion. But as a matter of constitutional substance, the majority's opinion has all the flaws its method would suggest, because laws in 1868 deprived women of any control over their bodies. The majority approves states doing so today. Today's decision strips women of agency over what even the majority agrees is a contested and contestable moral issue. It forces her to carry out the state's will, whatever the circumstances and whatever the harm it will wreak on her and her family. In the 14th Amendment's terms, it takes away her liberty.
Judy, the dissent had a lot of problems, obviously, with the majority opinion. First, the history. The point Justice Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor made very clearly was that the history that the majority relied upon, the laws at the time that they looked at, were all made by men. Women at the time did not have rights, basically any rights at all. So that was one flaw. The other flaw, very important flaw, they felt, was that the majority failed to stand by old precedents, and that's known as stare decisis. The dissent felt the majority did not properly apply the factors that the court has generally applied when determining whether to overrule an earlier precedent, factors like reliance and workability. And so I think those were the two main takeaways. One other thing I would add about the majority opinion, Judy, that I think is kind of important, is that going forward, how will courts judge abortion regulations and restrictions? And the majority opinion says that all a state has to do is justify that regulation on by a rational, reasonable basis. And that is considered the easiest form of constitutional scrutiny.
So what does that mean for these state courts?
It means state and federal courts will be probably upholding many more abortion regulations and restrictions than they have done in the past.
Marcia Coyle, beginning to digest this most historic and significant decision handed down today by the Supreme Court. Marcia, thank you.
My pleasure, Judy.
Today's decision is set to reshape where women may be able to access abortion services. John Yang has more now on how potential future legal battles could play out at the state level.
Judy, now that the right to an abortion has been overturned, an estimated 26 states are certain or likely to ban the procedure. That's according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. So what's next in the legal battle over abortion? Mary Ziegler is a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Her most recent book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Mary, thanks for being with us. We just showed that map from the Guttmacher Institute. What does this decision mean for a woman who may, let's say, in the coming days, learn she's pregnant and decide she wants to terminate it?
At the moment, that person would, in many of these states, only have the option to travel out of state or to try to self-manage an abortion. So essentially, what had been a constitutional right in all 50 states is now going to be protected in less than half.
What happens now to the legal battle over abortion? What's the next step? What's the next phase?
There are multiple phases, John. There are state constitutional battles unfolding in places like Michigan that is already the site of a struggle about whether there's a state constitutional right to abortion. There will be knockdown political battles in states like Florida and North Carolina that have yet to commit to having outright bans on abortion. And of course, there'll be legal battles as well. Conservatives will probably come back to the U.S. Supreme Court and ask for protection for fetal rights. States may try to regulate out-of-state conduct, right? Either preventing people from traveling to get abortions or preventing doctors in blue states from performing abortions on people from red states. Those fights, of course, raise very complicated legal questions that could well end back up at the Supreme Court.
You talked about abortion rights opponents coming back to the Supreme Court to talk about fetal rights. Talk about that. What will they be pressing for?
The idea that, and this has really been the main constitutional premise of the anti-abortion movement from the inception, is that the word person in the 14th Amendment, which of course guarantees equality under the law and due process of the law, applies before as well as after birth. So these advocates are going to be pressing the Supreme Court to recognize that claim. And of course, if the Supreme Court were to do that, that would have the effect of banning abortion everywhere, not just, of course, in states that may choose to do so.
So in other words, this would be a federal right, a constitutional right, but on the other side.
Exactly, right. I mean, and I don't anticipate that happening soon. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh, who's obviously would be a key vote on this, was trying, I think, to telegraph in his concurrence today, essentially that the Constitution is neutral, the Supreme Court should be neutral. So I don't think there are five votes at the moment for the recognition of fetal personhood. But of course, if you had asked me as little as 2 years ago, there weren't the votes to overturn Roe v. Wade. So this is a fast-moving topic where things can rapidly change.
You're a historian of the anti-abortion movement. What sort of give us the historian's context or view of today?
Well, I think it's a fairly unprecedented moment. There have been times when the Supreme Court has reversed decisions that discuss constitutional rights, but nothing exactly like this, really, I think, in modern history. It's also really remarkable, of course, that the Supreme Court has done this involving the most well-known Supreme Court decision, right? So the Supreme Court in this decision quite clearly says, this may damage the court's legitimacy, this may upset the American people, but, you know, that's not our problem, essentially. And that's a remarkable thing to see as well for a court that historically had been constrained by fears of public reaction. Clearly, this court is unconstrained. So this is a historic moment when it comes to the protections that are enjoyed by women and pregnant people. And it's a historical moment in terms of the role of the Supreme Court in our democracy.
Mary Ziegler of the University of California Davis Law School. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
We're going to hear from leaders on both sides of this issue about what comes next. First, I'm joined by Marjorie Dannenfelser. She's the president of the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America organization. Marjorie Dannenfelser, welcome to the NewsHour. So what is your reaction, the reaction of the anti-abortion movement? How much of a victory is this?
Well, for the pro-life movement, this is a culminating moment of 50 years of what we believe is the greatest human rights movement of our time. And every single abortion, there are two that must be served. And the experience of women since 1973, when they were told that this would be the great liberator, has not been that. It has been quite the opposite. And now that the states and the Congress, every elected body will be able to discuss this issue in the public square. The merits of the arguments will be meted out in ways that aren't closeted as the Supreme Court required all those 50 years ago. And the will of the people will make its way into the law, and women will be served in ways that they deserve.
I do want to ask you, because you told another reporter today, you said that you and others will work to ban abortion, and I'm quoting, in every state and in every legislature, including the Congress. So is your goal to ban abortion nationwide?
I think that if you look at what I said, you would see that I will work, and so will the pro-life movement, so will all the legislators, so will Democrats that don't like abortion after the first trimester, to work to be as ambitious as possible in every single legislature. That will be different state to state to state. North Carolina will be different from Alabama, will be different from Vermont and California. It means that the state law will reflect the will of those people.
We see, and you're aware of this, public opinion polls have been done by Pew. I mean, the NewsHour itself has commissioned polls in the last couple of months that show still that a majority of Americans thought that Roe should not be overturned, that most people believe American women should have a right to an abortion. So how does that public view square with what we're seeing today, do you think?
Judy, I have to believe that you have looked at the rest of those polls. When you look at the rest of those polls, you see that Democrats, women, diverse groups of people, this is not a partisan issue, think that abortion should at least be restricted in the second and third trimester. This seems reasonable to most people. Again, it doesn't please both sides, but it definitely is something that is a consensus in this nation. Doesn't reflect that poll bit that you just communicated. And it's because people want restrictions, people want limits that Roe simply would never have allowed. And that has not been understood. The other piece of this is the service to women is vital. And it has been going on. And this is a moment of flourishing to serve them in the way that our original women who got us into politics in the first place, Susan B. Anthony and the rest, saw as serving women and not allowing them to be exploited by the so-called abortion liberators who would liberate them by trying to build their rights on the broken rights of their children.
I do want to ask you one other question, Marjorie Dannenfelser, and that is one that comes up from the anti-abortion movement, and that is the fundamental unfairness of saying to women who don't have the financial means, who live in states where abortion will no longer be legal, that they are, in effect, either going to give birth to a child they are not prepared to give birth to, whereas women who have financial means are going to be able to travel somewhere if they want an abortion to get it. What about that?
Well, that would be unfair if that were true. But pro-life, not anti-abortion, is pro-life at birth and throughout life. And that is the commitment of the pro-life movement. It is my personal commitment, every leader that I know, and not just that small number of people, but the governors that I've spoken to, 22 so far, in the states that are most likely to limit abortion very early on. That commitment to those who are perceived as outliers, people who are perceived as can't manage allowing their children to be born. Those are the people that we go to first. Those are the people that we love. Love is at the center of this movement, and it is exactly what makes us flourish and why we will succeed.
Marjorie Dannenfelser, thank you very much. The president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now to Alexis McGill Johnson. She is the president of the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. It's the political arm of the country's largest abortion provider. Alexis McGill Johnson, thank you very much for joining us. So what is your reaction to this historic decision?
Well, obviously, Judy, I'm devastated. It is so challenging to have lost faith and hope in the institution that controls literally our bodies, our freedom. The fact that they came out with this decision, even though we saw a leaked version of it less than a month ago, it feels even harder to see it come to fruition.
What do you think the practical effect of it is going to be for American women, for American families?
The practical effect is that, people will have to go to great lengths to get out of their states to get access to care. We know that 26 states are poised to ban access to abortion or severely restrict access. We know that 36 million women and non-binary and trans folk will be affected by this decision. We know that people who would be most impacted are likely to be low income, rural, Black, Brown, Indigenous communities who may lack the resources to be able to get out of state. So it means that many people will be forced into pregnancy, and that will have a devastating consequence for the families they're currently caring for, much less themselves and their communities.
And what does it mean for Planned Parenthood and for other organizations like yours that support abortion rights? What do you do now?
Oh, look, I have lost hope in the court, but I have a lot of hope in the people. Now is the time for us to fight back. And that is exactly what we are planning to do. We are mobilizing people across the country to ensure that they know what is at stake, to ensure that every lawmaker, every corporation, every university understands the impact that this will have on their constituents, on their workforce, on their communities, on their students, and to ensure that no one gets to stay neutral in this moment. No one gets to say, well, that's a complicated, controversial issue I don't want to touch. When it starts to impact your community, you will have to take a stand, and we're going to force everyone who is in every community to have that conversation around what's at play right now.
The anti-abortion movement, many of its leaders are now saying they are not stopping with this. They are going to look now to try to ban abortion nationwide. How will you respond to that?
They've been forecasting this for so long. We can see how incredibly emboldened that they are, that they're showing their entire playbook. Not only do they want to push for a nationwide six-week ban, which Mitch McConnell said he would take up if he became Senate Majority Leader again, we know they will be moving to try to identify opportunities to amend the Constitution for other protections. So we have to fight back and be just as relentless to fight their extremism. And that is exactly what we are going to do.
And finally, Alexis McGill-Johnson, what is your message to young women, to families who are out there listening to this, listening to you right now, who are questioning what it means for them and what they should do now? What is your message?
You know, my message is the same message I gave to my daughter, my 13-year-old daughter, 10-year-old daughter, both of whom are going to grow up with less rights than I have enjoyed for the last 49 years of my life. And I told them, we are going to fight this at every turn. Now is the time to be engaged in the fight. Now is the time to make sure that future generations continue to maintain and hold rights. We have to make sure that every movement understands that we have to make it relevant for every single generation. And we want young women to grow up in a world where they are able to pursue their own freedom, their own imagination. And we are going to continue to fight with them and for them until they take the baton so they can fight along with us.
Alexis McGill-Johnson, the president of the Planned Parenthood Action Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And for an even closer look at how this decision impacts Americans and how organizations are responding on the ground, we turn to Amna Nawaz.
That's right, Judy. We'll get two perspectives. I'm joined first by Michael Gonadakis. He's president of the group Ohio Right to Life. He's been with the organization for more than 14 years. Michael, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for making the time. There have been people working towards this decision for 50 years. You have been working towards it for 14. Just help me understand, what is this moment like for you?
It's historic. You know, never in my lifetime did I believe it would come to this, and here we are today, and we have a monumental task ahead of us. Our work is not done. It's just begun. We need to ensure that we have the greatest social service safety net here in the state of Ohio to help all women, especially women who find themselves in an unintended pregnancy.
Let me ask you about that work ahead and your resources there, because women in Ohio, like a lot of women around the country, lived through a pandemic. They were disproportionately affected when it comes to workforce participation. I saw in Ohio, rental prices have been soaring like they've been everywhere else. We're living with record inflation. You're a nonprofit. How can you support these women? Do you have the funding and resources you need?
Well, we don't, as an organization, to help every single woman in Ohio, of course, but we do have our tax dollars through the legislature and our governor, who's pro-life as well, Mike DeWine. And what we've done from budget upon budget is find extra dollars or take dollars that we currently have and send them to help with WIC, help with SNAP, help with different programs that help women, whether it be for prenatal care or their own health care. We supported Medicaid expansion in Ohio and still do today. We think every woman should have access to a doctor no matter what. And we believe if we continue these common sense approaches at our city, county, and state level, the resources are there to ensure every woman who finds themselves an unintended pregnancy will have everything they need to have a healthy baby and raise their child or place their child for adoption.
You're confident those resources are already there, or they will be there?
They are already there. We have a $7 billion rainy day fund too, and our coffers are full, and we are spending the money now. Our governor continues to provide extra money for women, for diapers, formulas, for parenting classes, and the like, and he's doing a great job.
We should mention, too, in Ohio, the governor back in 2019 signed a so-called heartbeat bill, right, which effectively banned abortions at around 6 weeks or so. It's been held up in a court. It's likely to go into place. But even with that, if a woman in Ohio becomes pregnant, she can still travel out of state. She could still order in medication abortion. How does your group approach that?
Yeah, you know, we're at a new frontier here. You know, we're dealing with issues that we're seeing for the first time here. Of course, there is no law, nor would there be a law that would restrict someone's ability to cross state lines for any reason whatsoever. I'll tell you, on the heartbeat bill, breaking news, the federal judge just lifted the injunction. So 10 minutes ago now, the law in Ohio is the heartbeat standard as of 10 minutes ago. And as it relates to mail order prescriptions, you know, we can't regulate the internet at this time, of course, not a state or the federal government. So we're going to have to sit down and tackle these issues together as a nation, as a state on how we ensure that women aren't ordering unsafe drugs from China or Mexico or wherever else.
Well, let me ask you about that briefly in just a few seconds. We know that outlawing abortion doesn't end abortion. How worried are you women will turn to increasingly dangerous means to end pregnancies?
Well, we think with the right type of care that I've spoke about already and ways, whether it be our church or it be other types of opportunities to help women and demonstrate to them that they have the care they need, the health care, the prenatal care, and every county, all 88 counties, Ohio, that they're going to have that access. And it's there today.
That is Mike Gonadakis. He's president of the group Ohio Right to Life. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And joining me now to talk about how her group will respond to today's decision is Kelly Davis. She's executive director for the New Voices for Reproductive Justice. That's a nonprofit working in Ohio and Pennsylvania to help Black women, girls, and trans people. Kelly Davis, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for joining us. Tell me about what this decision means specifically for the people you serve, and what are they telling you today?
Well, today is a devastating day, but if you're surprised, you haven't been paying attention. As we've heard throughout today's broadcast, folks have been working in concert across this nation to limit folks' human rights, including access to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health care, which includes abortion. Across the two states that we represent, we know that those that are most impacted by abortion restrictions are Black women and gender expansive folks.
So let me ask you about Ohio and Pennsylvania, where you also work, because a lot of folks predict now, because of the tightening rules in Ohio, and as you just heard, that so-called heartbeat bill just going into effect there, Pennsylvania providers will see a surge of women coming in from Ohio, from West Virginia, from elsewhere. Can you handle that? Can other providers handle that? Do you have the resources you need?
Well, for the states where abortion is still legal to absorb, the influx of patients from states where abortion is now illegal because of trigger bans, we know that that can't possibly be the case. Also, not everyone has the means to be able to travel. Again, folks that are disabled, folks that are living in poverty, who do not have access to sick leave or childcare, are having challenges traveling. Also, to ask a healthcare system, which has been plagued by infectious disease, and record numbers of resignations and ill healthcare workforce to absorb even more of an influx of patients is morally and epidemiologically unconscionable.
Kelly, you just heard Michael Gonadakis say that he's confident there are state resources available in Ohio. They will step up. They will support these women. Do you believe that will happen?
No, because it hasn't happened. States have had horrible budget deficits because of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Ohio, we have children today living in poverty, right? We have infant formula shortage, right? And so, and a worsening Black maternal morbidity and mortality crisis. And that was with Roe being the law of the land. Without it, we all know those things are going to skyrocket, causing widespread death and disability, which maims communities of color the most.
So once abortions now, as we know, are essentially banned in Ohio, just give me a real life example here. If there's a woman there, this new heartbeat bill has gone into effect, she becomes pregnant, she wants to end her pregnancy, what are her options? What can she do?
Well, I just want to say that a 6-week abortion ban is effectively a 100% abortion ban because the vast majority of people do not know that they're pregnant within 6 weeks of their pregnancy. And so now this person, this hypothetical person, but this is the real life for tens of thousands of people across the state, have to secure childcare, have to take off of work, sometimes have to travel to neighboring states that require multiple doctor's visits, have to pay out of pocket, right? All of those things we know, particularly marginalized groups, do not have access to. But that's what we're committed within the reproductive justice movement to giving folks the access that they need wherever abortion is legal today.
Kelly Davis, in the few seconds we have left, how does this change the work you do? What are you doing differently today that you weren't doing before?
It doesn't change anything. We're just working smarter, harder, faster, with more commitment and passion now more than ever.
That is Kelly Davis, Executive Director of the New Voices for Reproductive Justice, joining us tonight. Thank you for joining us.
In the day's other news, the U.S. House of Representatives gave final approval to a $15 billion gun violence bill, the first of its kind in nearly three decades. It had passed the Senate last night, with 15 Republicans joining all 50 Democrats. Today's debate and vote in the House was much more down party lines.
To the members who lack the courage to join in this work, to those who lack the courage to join in this work, I say your political survival is insignificant compared to the survival of our children.
Congress is moving full steam ahead to restrict the right to self-defense for law-abiding gun owners and the right to due process for all Americans. This legislation is the wrong approach, and we ought to oppose it.
Among other things, the measure curbs gun sales to people convicted of domestic violence, and it helps fund state laws to take guns away from people who are deemed dangerous. In Ukraine, government forces conceded control of the eastern city of Severodonetsk, a major milestone in Russia's advance across the Luhansk region. The regional governor said that fighters were pulling back to avoid being encircled.
Now we're in the situation where it makes no sense to stay in positions that have been smashed to pieces during many months of fighting, because the number of casualties in these poorly fortified areas will grow every day.
Russian forces are also advancing on Lysychansk across a river from Severodonetsk. It now becomes the last major pocket of Ukrainian resistance in the region. The official earthquake death toll in eastern Afghanistan has risen to 1,150. That word came today as the devastated region shuddered again with a heavy aftershock. Survivors struggled to find food and shelter and waited for aid that is slowly trickling in. The UN Human Rights Office today blamed Israeli troops for the death of Shireen Abu Akleh, a Palestinian-American journalist. She was shot dead last month during unrest in the occupied West Bank. The UN review concluded that she was hit by, quote, seemingly well-aimed bullets fired by Israelis, not Palestinians, and it called for a full investigation.
More than 6 weeks after the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh and the injury of her colleague Ali Samoudi in Jenin on the 11th of May 2022, it is deeply disturbing that Israeli authorities have not conducted a criminal investigation.
Israel has denied that its soldiers targeted Abu Akleh. It also called again for the Palestinians to share access to the fatal bullet. The Palestinians have refused, saying they do not trust the Israelis to conduct a legitimate investigation. Record-breaking heat has hit more highs today all around the northern hemisphere. Cities in northern China had readings of 107 degrees. In the Russian Arctic, it was nearly 90 on Thursday, and 15 states across the U.S. had highs of 100 degrees. Scientists say the extreme heat this early in the year is likely linked to climate change. The people of Surfside, Florida, marked 1 year today since 98 people were killed when a condominium tower collapsed. First Lady Jill Biden was among those honoring the victims at the now cleared site where the 12-story building once stood. The cause of the collapse is still under investigation. And Wall Street closed out a week that recouped much of last week's losses. Stocks rose on hopes that interest rates won't need to rise so much if the economy cools. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 823 points on the day, 2.7%, to close at 31,500. The Nasdaq rose 375 points, 3.3%. The S&P 500 was up 3%.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade has sent Washington into overdrive as observers consider the political and cultural ramifications. That brings us to the analysis of Capehart and Gerson. That is Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, and his colleague at The Post, opinion columnist Michael Gerson. David Brooks is away. And we welcome both of you to the NewsHour on this Friday night. And Jonathan, I'm going to start with you with the story that is all over the news today, and that is the Supreme Court. What is your reaction?
Well, I think I worked out my, not rage, but my alarm. Alarm is the right word. When the leak of Justice Alito's draft opinion overturning Roe versus Wade was leaked last month, and in reading it, I saw, you know, Roe is being overturned, but a bunch of other rights to privacy would be weakened if Roe were overturned. With the decision out today, it hews closely to that draft opinion. And, you know, I'm sitting here still trying to process what it means to live in a post-Roe world. Because we've got states that had trigger laws that the moment Roe was overturned, abortion was made illegal. And my heart goes out to women who now who live in states where their right to choose their own reproductive health care is no longer their decision. And I feel and my heart goes out to those families, because it's not only a personal decision for the woman, for the person who's pregnant. It's a decision that impacts an entire family. There are men out there who are going to be dealing with this as well. So in the hours that we've been trying to digest all this, I'm still trying to get my head around what this means. But this much I know, it's not good.
Michael, your thoughts?
Well, I had a similar reaction in one way. I mean, I come from a pro-life background. But this, I found my views very mixed today. We are a nation with an escalating culture war. And placing this issue right now in the center of our national debate in states across the country is going to be deeply divisive. It's a terrible time, to talk about this set of issues. I also thought that there were a couple of good points made in criticism in the decision itself. One of them is by Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that
criticizing the main opinion.
The main opinion. He concurred, but criticized. It's a very prickly opinion, essentially saying, I would have done it differently. You did not need to overturn Roe completely in order to answer this Mississippi case. He actually, he said that this ruling, was a ruling all the way down to the studs. And that was, to see that kind of dissent within the majority was kind of interesting. And then there was I thought the dissent made the decision or made the point very well. That Alito says in the decision that this does not affect other cases that have to do with sexual privacy. Right. But he doesn't make a particularly good argument about why his reasoning would not, okay?
Yeah.
And there could be good reasons. Maybe John Roberts could write them, okay? But the reality is that was left a little bit blank. I think it's going to cause some consternation.
What do you think this says, Jonathan, about the court, what we're looking at here?
I think the credibility of the court is now more on the line than ever. I hesitate to say that the legitimacy of the court is in question or at risk, because that's a step too far. But when you read this decision and you read the concurring opinions, the legitimacy of the court is going, I think, will be eroded. And to Michael's point about Alito saying, don't worry, this only applies to abortion. He made that same argument in that draft opinion, and that is what raised my alarm. And just to put it,
just to sort of be an exclamation point on Alito's don't worry, don't worry, you have the senior most justice, Justice Clarence Thomas, putting in writing, in future cases, we should reconsider all of this court's substantive due process precedents, including Griswold, Lawrence, and Obergefell. Obergefell, the right to same-sex marriage. Lawrence, that guaranteed a right to privacy to same-sex intimate contact. Griswold, right of married couples to have access to contraception. All of these decisions, they're grounded. Roe is their foundation. And so now, as an out gay married man, I'm now faced officially with the prospect of my marriage being rendered illegal.
Do you think this decision tells us something new about this court?
Well, it certainly, given the frustration of the Chief Justice, it tells us this is not the Roberts Court, okay? Mm-hmm. This is someone else's court. It's the leadership is being, shown by the five justices themselves, not including Roberts. And, that's an awkward position for him to be in. But even he, this is a 6-3 decision, has accepted the basic point here, which is the point of the conservative legal revolution over the last several decades, which is if the Constitution doesn't say it, okay, then we cannot create rights, okay? And there's an additional element here that I want to say, which is one point that Alito makes is that there are actually two groups with visions of human rights at stake here, okay? Not just one, okay? And one of those groups, the pro-life people in America, were told by Roe v. Wade, you can never win, okay? They were essentially disenfranchised, at least in their own minds. And that was also a source of division in our country for 50 years. It's a perilous decision whichever way you go, but I think that there are some arguments to be made in favor of it.
Perilous, Jonathan. And do you see it having a political effect in this already fraught election year?
Oh, absolutely. At a time when Democrats are facing headwinds, historic headwinds in terms of trying to maintain control of the House, maybe even maintaining control of the Senate, a Democratic Party base that might be frustrated because criminal justice reform wasn't done or voting rights wasn't done. But now we're looking at a woman's right to choose gone, looking at other rights potentially on the chopping block. This is a galvanizing issue, I think, for Republicans and Democrats, but particularly for Democrats or folks who are in favor of abortion rights because now they have lost something. And the only way to get it back is to put more Democrats in the House, put more Democrats in the Senate, so that they can codify the right to abortion by law. That's the only way that's going to be done now.
Michael, do you see this energizing Democrats more than Republicans?
Probably, for that very reason. This is a right withdrawn, okay? It doesn't mean that abortion is illegal all over the country, but it means that it's illegal in some places. And I think that, it's likely to concern Democrats because they've lost something. I think that that's exactly right. The problem here, of course, though, not to get too much into the politics of it, is the outcome of midterm elections is most directly tied to the popularity of the sitting president. That's what Gallup runs their model, is that if you're below 50 as president, you're going to lose more than 30 seats. That's the history. Okay,
right.
Does this make President Biden more popular? I'm not sure that that's true. He's hardly a culture war fighter on these issues. He gave a speech today that had some of those elements. But I think there can be an effect on the Democratic base, but this is still a very tough election for Democrats.
Although President Biden is not on the ballot, There are individual members of the House, right, folks in the Senate who are running, and they can run and say, if you want to, you want to get these things back, if you want to fortify the rights that we have, you must elect Democrats, because they are the ones who are going to do whatever it takes, if they have the big enough majorities, to codify abortion rights and protect marriage equality and protect the legal right to contraception.
And we're already seeing candidates around the country bringing this up, saying today, we're going to take this to the voters. We're going to talk about this. Michael, I want to, we're talking about the court. Let's talk about the other decision that the court handed down this week, negating New York's regulations on who can carry guns out in the open. That came down from the court at the same time Congress has now passed the first anything close to gun control legislation in decades. Where are we on guns in this country, given all that?
Well, Americans have every right to be confused with the courts coming down strongly in favor of state legislatures when it comes to abortion, and undermining a 100-year-old law in the New York legislature was a perfectly reasonable law. Okay. But it relates to the earlier question. I do think that there is a concern on Robert's part of a judicial activism on the right. Okay. So whatever the favored right is, the right has found ways to do this. But I also don't want to downplay what the Congress did on this measure. This was the first of its type in 30 years.
Right.
And the reality is that it was a demonstration to some extent of the way, you know, Congress should work. I mean, you make compromises and you have incremental reform. That's what American democracy does, okay? And so, I think there's a lot to praise there, and that included some Republicans, even though they're a lot of them not coming back or are not running in the next year, you know. But it was, I think, well done.
But you do have, and Jonathan, you've got the court going in one direction on guns, mm-hmm. and the Congress, in this instance, going in another direction.
Well, the Congress is reacting to real-time horrors. Uvalde, Buffalo, plus the 200-plus other mass shootings that have happened in this country since the beginning of the year. And so the fact that they were able to do something, as incremental as it is, it's the first time it's been done, as Michael said, in 30 years. And so this should be celebrated and should also be recognized as an opportunity. If Congress shows the ability to pass something on guns, they can do it again. Mm-hmm. And so, but when it comes to the court's decision, it's another thing that worries me. This idea of a reliance on ordinary self-defense. Ordinary self-defense is very subjective. And when you are a person of color, do you get the presumption of self-defense? We've seen many instances where the answer is no.
A lot still to interpret
on
that one. Jonathan Capehart, Michael Gerson, thank you for being with us on this historic evening.
Thank you.
And for more coverage of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, please join us for a special program at 8 p.m. Eastern here on PBS and streaming online. And following that, join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her Washington Week panel for additional analysis. That's all tonight on PBS. And with that, that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening on PBS News Weekend. Jeff Bennett will have the latest on the response to the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.